You've probably seen a few cars with those 26.2 stickers on the bumper, indicating that the owner of the car ran a marathon, 26.2 miles. It is not a feat for everyone. 26 miles is more than the human body is really built to run at one time. In this hour, we'll hear about running 7 marathons in 7 days on 7 continents. Definitely not for everyone. But the first World Marathon Challenge set out to stage such a series of events beginning in early 2015. Our guest won and will forever be known as the first champion of the event. David Gething must know a few things about what the body will endure because he's a veterinary surgeon in Hong Kong. He travels and trains and races a lot, not just for the World Marathon Challenge. He's run the Boston Marathon and the Ironman Triathlon, among many other events on foot, on wheels, or in the water. David Gething, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on today. Most appreciated.
I appreciate you staying up. It's what, 1 in the morning there?
Yeah, it's getting on a bit late, but actually I had a bit of a trick. I went to bed first and got back up again.
Okay, good to have you. Hope the coffee will keep you with us for a while. So you were not the health nut well into your adult years. Tell us about what your condition was and what changed.
Actually, you're completely right. I mean, I was, I must have been 33 years old and I was going on about 250 pounds. So I was a big guy and I was sort of drinking and smoking and not just having a lot of fun, having a lot of a good time. And with my first daughter coming along, my wife sort of sat me down one day and said, look, you got to have a think about, you know, what kind of role model are you going to be? And she sort of put her foot down and said, it's time to get fit. And I guess I sort of took her up on that, and maybe I think she wishes now she hadn't said anything. Maybe I've taken a bit too far.
She just thought maybe you'd walk a few miles or something, huh?
Well, you know, it's the original plan, right? But I think once I got the bit between my teeth, I couldn't stop. And I'll be honest with you, it wasn't that easy journey. I mean, you sort of, when you start out with no fitness at all, it takes a long time, and you know, took a long time to build up, but little by little, you get better. And you just got to keep putting one foot in front of the other, and eventually you get there.
So what was the source of the lack of attention to fitness? It sounds like your birth family were not terribly athletic.
No, that's exactly it, right? It was never really a big thing in my family. And I think, to be honest with you, I mean, I live in Hong Kong, and in Hong Kong, you can kind of live a very fun life if you want to, and you can sort of party every night and have a great time. And I guess you get caught up in that a little bit. And I got a bit carried away. And I should be clear, nothing really bad, nothing illegal or out of sorts, just a lot, far too much of a good time for too long. I don't regret those days. It was great to have them. But there's also comes a time when, as I say, when you start having children, and I think it's also you get a bit older and you realize can't do this forever. And got to try and get a bit healthier.
So it was at that point when you had been living the fun expat life in Hong Kong. You're from Sydney, Australia, originally. That your wife said, David, we need to talk. This is your wife, Trilby White. At first, did you resist at all, or did you think, oh wow, she kind of nailed me?
You know what? I think I kind of knew she was right. You know, sometimes you know in the back of your head what you kind of should be doing, and I think. She's also the kind of woman who doesn't put her foot down that often. And when she does, you better listen up. Otherwise, yeah, you'd be making a mistake. So I guess, I tell you what, the next day I woke up, and I to scare myself straight, I signed up for a 250-kilometer ultramarathon in China. It was 1 year later. But I figured I needed something to really, you know, terrify me enough to get up every morning and train and to, you know, to be a good boy from then on. So I guess I knew she was right from the start.
So, David, how did you start? And I guess more importantly, where? Because, I mean, Hong Kong Island, for example, I know you live on the mainland, but, it's steep enough for escalators, and it's a kind of rolling, hilly country there.
Oh, you're not wrong. It's there's no flat land, and I heard your weather forecast before, and I thought, my goodness, I wish I was there, because it's you know, twice as hot and 95% humidity here.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's that kind of thing where you go for a kilometer at a time, then you have a rest, and then you get better and you go for 2 kilometers and 3 kilometers. I figure maybe the hills and the heat make for good training. It makes you tougher than the next guy.
Well, so how long training before you get into your, and it was actually a bicycle race was the first one, wasn't it?
Exactly. So, I mean, as I did mention that ultra marathon, but you're totally right that I had a whole lot of smaller goals between there to try and, you know, get fitter, because you can't just do an ultra marathon as your first race. That was sort of the halo goal at the end of the tunnel. But yeah, I, you know, I guess as a big guy, I got into bike racing before I got into running, because sort of easier to do some cycling, and I fell in with some local guys who are, it's always good to have friends around and to push you forward and help you, and they sort of got me involved, and the first thing was a cycle race, then some running races, and then sort of took away from there, kept going more and more. And I think the thing is, you sort of see what you can do, and you think, okay, if I can do this, what else can I do? And you make it a little bit harder and a little bit harder, get better and better.
So was Trilby early on overjoyed or concerned about how energetically you seem to be taking all this on?
I think probably a little bit gobsmacked more than anything else, I think a bit surprised. Look, I think, you know, she was very, very happy. And I think, in fairness, she probably also wanted to get a little bit healthier, not quite take it to the extreme, but I think if we both went on a bit of a health kick, it did a lot of good for both of us. And by extension, our children when they came along too. You know, I think, and I should be clear, I think everything's about balance. I don't want them to be only into sport or running, but I think they need to be careful with their health and their fitness as well as they do with their schooling and everything else. So it's all about being a bit of an example, I guess.
We were talking to David Gething about running 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 days as part of the World Marathon Challenge, which he won the initial version of in early 2015. His book is called Relentless. We'll come back and talk more with David about his exploits and how much he remembers of them. He was probably in a bit of a fog given the jet lag and the fatigue, but we'll hear a lot more about what happened across those 7 continents in 7 days. When we come back to the Jefferson Exchange to talk more with David Gething in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We're having a conversation with Australian expat David Gething, living in Hong Kong, working as a veterinary surgeon, but also spending a lot of time training for marathons and bike races and triathlons and swimming events, all kinds of things. But he finally took on 7 marathons, 7 continents in 7 days in the World Marathon Challenge in early 2015 and won. His book is called Relentless. Gives us a guide to what it was like to not only win, but just to take part in such an incredible undertaking. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange and compare notes. Maybe you have had some moments of severe, grueling tests of endurance in your life. 800-838-3760 to join by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You mentioned, David, signing up for a 250-mile ultramarathon in China. And how did you do in that?
I finished. I can't say I didn't. I didn't win it, put it that way, but I finished. So I finished kind of okay, I think about halfway down the rankings. But it was an amazing experience, right? You're out in the middle of the desert in China, and it's just not the China that I expected or knew at all. It was more like something from, I don't know, from Morocco or something like that. It was beautiful, and it was worth doing. And I guess that's kind of what gave me the bug of the traveling around the world to these different weird races in weird places and see things I'd never see again.
Well, I mean, you did the Boston Marathon, among others. But I understand that from the way it comes out in the book, it sounds like you began to think about marathons on 7 continents slightly before the World Marathon Challenge was announced.
Well, yeah, I had this idea, and I guess Boston was part of that. I wanted to try and run. There's a thing in marathon running called the Marathon Grand Slam, where you run the big ones, which are things like, you know, New York and London and Boston and Berlin, Tokyo. And I kind of thought that was a bit like it could take a whole lifetime to get into all those marathons and do it all. But I guess I planted that seed for why not try and run one on every continent and see where it goes from there. And I guess that's how it all got started, how it got the ball rolling.
And so who organized the World Marathon Challenge?
So there's a guy called Richard Donovan. And what happened was I was sort of looking around and Googling around to try and see, you know, what marathons are in what countries and how you could do this. And I found this guy who'd done it before, who'd run 7 marathons just as a you know, a personal goal, not as part of a race, but just gone and turned up for a country and run a marathon. And I got in touch with him, and he sort of was just at the stage of thinking about doing this race, and he sort of said, well, look, if you want to come along, I'll send you an email. And I didn't hear anything for 6 months, and then suddenly one day in my email inbox, I got an email saying, you know, are you in or are you out? And that was it. I knew I was in.
Wow. So running aside, I mean, how hard to get from place to place on Earth to even start the races?
Look, I reckon you're totally right. And I about halfway through the event, I thought, I'm the guy with the easy job. I just got to turn up and run today, whereas this guy's got to get me around from here to the next race and keep going. You know, we didn't really particularly stop. So we, just to be clear, we started in Antarctica and then went to Chile for South America, Miami for North America, Madrid for Europe, Morocco for Africa, Dubai for Asia, and then finished under the Harbour Bridge in Sydney, Australia. And we had 168 hours, which is 7 calendar days, from when we started in Antarctica to when we finished in Sydney. So there was literally no time to stop, and there's also no time for errors. And that meant, you know, we'd run a marathon, and then we'd go straight to the airport, we'd get on a plane. And these were, apart from the Antarctica flight, everything else was just regular commercial airlines, just lined up really, really well to get between place to place. But look, it was one of those things, if anything went wrong, if any flight was cancelled or delayed, it would have blown the whole thing out.
Wow, so everything worked out? I mean, everybody got to where they needed to be, at least to start the races?
Well, that was the amazing thing, right? And it was, I mean, the race was run as 12 runners from around the world. And there was, you know, guys and girls from all over the world, from India and Australia and Ireland, Hong Kong for me, US, Canada. And we all started every race, and amazingly enough, we all finished every race, and we all got through it. We all reached the finish line and did the 7 marathons and 7 continents in 7 days. I got to admit, we're all pretty banged up and bruised by the end of it, but we all got through it.
Banged up and bruised, to put it mildly. We're talking to David Gething about running 7 marathons on 7 continents in 7 days. His book about winning the initial World Marathon Challenge is called Relentless. While these distances covered, I look particularly at the flight, like from Punta Arenas in Chile to Miami, a very long distance. From Dubai to Sydney, a very long distance. How many miles did you guys rack up, even aside from the 26.2 times 7 in the marathons themselves?
Absolutely total flying time for me was 88,000 miles, all said and done.
Wow.
That includes getting there and getting back. So it was about 55,000 miles on the actual race, which is a lot of time in airplanes in 7 days. But on the flip side, whenever you're in the airplane, that's your time to rest and recover. So it's actually kind of the nice time of the race because you can sleep and try and get a bit of energy back.
Hold on. I think this is what makes you the world record holder. You can sleep in an airline seat?
Oh, I can now. I'll tell you what, I never could before this race, but I learned pretty quick. And I tell you what, by the end of it, you could have laid me down on a seat of a bed of nails and I would have slept. I didn't care by the end of it.
Probably. What kind of support did you guys have along the way in the World Marathon Challenge? I mean, medical or food or water?
I mean, the organizer definitely would have taken care of anything that would have been a problem. But really, we pretty much were up to our own devices. There was not really any... Of course, there was, you know, medical support if there was a problem, but otherwise... Yeah, we bought our own food with us and took care of ourselves pretty much.
Talk about whether it was enough to do this. Was this like, you know, Sir Edmund Hillary, it was there, or was it you had to win too?
I didn't go in with any intention of winning. I mean, I guess to be realistic, you never know who else is in the race. You never know how you're going to go. And there's just so many variables in a race like that. All I really wanted to do is conquer the challenge. And I think when I started to realize I might have a shot at winning was when it actually became quite scary and terrifying, because then you've got another additional challenge over just finishing. It's even more pressure, which makes it more difficult. But I, you know, until the last day, until the last five kilometers, I didn't know. It wasn't the cat's in the bag right until the end. There was always up to play for.
Talk about the initial takeoff. What went through your mind once you settled into your seat to fly to South America to do the first marathon, which actually was in Antarctica?
It's a good question, right? I think the thing is, when I jumped on that plane, you know, to get to the starting line, it's the first time that your mind can settle and say, okay, I really am going to do this now. I've done the training. I've done everything else I can do. I can't get any fitter. I can't get any healthier. But my goodness, I've only really got one. There's only one more thing I actually have to do, and that's the actual race itself. And I guess it becomes a bit exhilarating, but also a bit terrifying.
Once you arrived, you knew some of the people. Tell us about the Hardy crew that had signed up for this event with you.
It was a great bunch. I'd never met any of them before, but I'd sort of talked to them on email and so forth just before the race, trying to get to know them. And I guess a race like this attracts real characters, but they were just people from all walks of life and all people who were maybe, how would I put it, eccentric in the best way and had their, myself included in that, but all very driven people. I mean, there was a guy who was a school boarding master from England who was hilariously funny. There was an ultra runner for Australia who was a really sort of spiritual guy. A lady from Finland who'd starred on Big Brother Finland. An Indian couple who were pharmaceutical giants. Just all these kind of totally random people. But the amazing thing was, for a week, he became really close buddies. And I got to say, if any of those guys turned up on my doorstep today, which a couple of them had since the race, I'd welcome like a long lost friend, you know, and you really make a bond out there.
David Gething is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's a veterinary surgeon living in Hong Kong, and he's also a bit of a runner on the side, also bicycles and swims. He's participated in triathlons and marathons, but he also took part in the World Marathon Challenge in the beginning of 2015. 7 marathons, 7 continents, 7 days. His book about the experience is called Relentless. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, if you have questions for Dr. Gething, or maybe you can share some experiences similar to these. It'd be hard-pressed to know people who did that, but 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So we've established you're from Australia. You're living in Hong Kong. You mentioned it's about twice the temperature and many times the humidity. So what did Antarctica look like to those eyes?
See, this was the crazy thing. I don't know whether I was gutsy or stupid, but I'd actually never seen it snowing before I got to Antarctica. Because growing up in Sydney and living in Hong Kong, it doesn't snow here. So I was totally gobsmacked. I'd just never seen it before. It was amazing. It was stunningly beautiful. But the thing I didn't realize about Antarctica is there's nothing there. I mean, there's no trees, there's no birds, there's penguins on the coast. We were right in the inland. There's nothing at all. No polar bears. That's the Arctic. No houses. No nothing. It's just stunningly white and stunningly beautiful.
And so then, how keep track of runners in a vast whiteness? How keep track of where you are? It's not like you have reference points like I'll turn at that pine tree, that kind of thing.
Well, they did. So each one of the marathon courses was properly measured and marked out. And certified, because to be sort of valid for the records, they had to make sure each course was what they call IAAF approved, which is like the official body approved. So they did lay down small blue flags every, I think it was 50 meters in the snow. And they ran a sort of a grader plow along the snow to plow a trail. They also had to run a ground penetrating radar because there's crevasses that open up in the snow and you could fall into one and be in trouble. So they had to make sure it was safe by running this sort of radar array. And you were told literally do not go off the track because we haven't marked it. If it goes wrong, you could fall and you can't be recovered. We'll lose you. So you had to stick quite close to where they'd said no questions asked. The problem with that was that halfway through it became a bit of a snowstorm, so you just sort of had to run marker to marker. You couldn't really see much further ahead than 50 meters, 100 feet.
Wow, that is just amazing. And what was your time was generally somewhere around 3.5 hours for each of these, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I took these a little bit slower than I normally run a marathon because just I figure the faster you run, the more damage you do. And a race like this really is more about conserving and not damaging yourself, and it's not about how you run on day 2, it's about how you run on day 7 that wins or loses it. And so a little bit slower than normal. I think I averaged about 3:25 or something. I did 3:21 I think in Antarctica, and that was apparently a new world record, and that still stands today. But I am going to tell you the other side of that story, that there aren't that many people who've run a marathon in Antarctica, so I'm not going to claim on that big a deal.
All right, we'll take the caveat there. So, sure. How do you dress for running a race? I mean, you're trying to not freeze to death, but at the same time, it sounds like from your descriptions, you're trying not to sweat at the same time.
Well, look, you're totally right. And this was the biggest problem with Antarctica is that, before we got up, there was a doctor at the base camp and he had a briefing with us all. And he said, I'm going to tell you guys one thing, you know, if you sweat, you'll die because your T-shirt, your top will get full of water and will freeze almost instantly. And that will form a plate of ice around your chest and you'll become hypothermic and there's nothing we can do. So it's a real trick that you had to dress cool enough that you didn't sweat and use sort of body heat from running to keep you warm, which meant that you couldn't stop running, otherwise you'd also get cold. When I went out there, I was wearing a long sleeve T-shirt and long trousers and a windbreaker on top, and that was it, and a beanie in 0 degrees or lower, and Antarctic snowstorm. So it was a bit of a gamble, but it actually paid off really well. I think, as you mentioned in the introduction, one thing that did go wrong that I didn't think of is I was wearing a woolen beanie, and I did sweat into that. And the doctor actually stopped me halfway around at a checkpoint and pulled it off my head, and I was frozen solid. And I didn't want to let go because I was getting pretty cold. And he said, no, I've got to take it off your head. And he smashed it on the table for me, and shards of ice went everywhere. And he said, look, it was frozen solid. It would have been a big problem.
Well, I was about to ask if that's the sharpest lingering memory from the Antarctic leg, or what is the sharpest lingering memory? Is that it? Having your hat break?
That was pretty amazing. It's really odd. I've not really experienced cold weather so much, but my whole face went numb. And you talk and you sound like you're drunk or you're numb or something like that. So I couldn't really feel the cold beanie. That was just an amazing experience to realize that I could have been in trouble there had he not been watching over us and being careful about it. I got to say, my memory really of Antarctica was that kind of that crossing the finish line, being told I'd broken the world record. But more than that, I guess when I think about it, it was being out in the middle of nowhere and somewhere just so beautiful and so pristine that very few people have been lucky enough to see. And that was amazing.
It really is well described, too. We're talking to David Gething, a veterinary surgeon from Hong Kong and a racer of many long-distance races, including the World Marathon Challenge, 7 continents, 7 days. His book is Relentless, and we're talking to him about that on the Jefferson Exchange. So you talked about sleeping between marathons. So once you're done with Antarctica, you have to get back on this military transport, and it does sound like one of those rattly old military planes with no particular interior comforts and just sort of ribs and seats and that sort of thing. And yet you managed to sleep on the way back to Chile with that?
Yeah, even on that stage, I was sleeping. You're totally right. It was this old sort of Soviet transport plane. They were using it to sort of ferry Argentinian soldiers, actually, backwards and forwards from one of the bases down there. And we were lucky enough to get on the same plane, and that's how we got down there and back, because there's no commercial flights. This thing was solid as a rock, but it was also something out of the 70s Soviet era. It was built for purpose and not for looks. But I tell you, coming back on that from that first marathon, it was everybody's mission to get one of those seats and sit down. And we all made sure we got one and tried to get a few winks of sleep in. Again, it wasn't comfy, but after running a marathon, I could pretty much sleep anywhere. I was fine.
What else could you do for recovery between the races as you shuffled from continent to continent?
I mean, I did have a plan with that, and I did use things like, you have recovery socks, which are sort of these high compression socks that you put on straight after the race to try and push all of the bad stuff out. Some people say they work and some people say they don't, but I think it couldn't hurt to try. I'd make sure I ate something as soon as possible after the race, try and get some energy back in. And also just not doing anything apart from the race. I wouldn't be walking around, it wasn't time to see the sights, but I wouldn't be walking around the airport just out of curiosity or anything like that. I was either sitting or I was running. That was kind of my goal.
What do the high compression socks do?
So the idea is you've got these sort of high compression socks that go literally the whole way up to your thigh, and they're designed to sort of push all of the lactic acid and bad stuff out of your legs and try and allow your legs to recover and provide some support. So the idea is they sort of accelerate the regeneration of the muscles. And look, some people say they work great and some people say they don't really do much at all. I figure, nothing broken, can't can't hurt but try. But have you ever seen those anti-DVT socks that people wear on airplanes? They look similar to that.
Oh, sure, to keep them from getting a thrombosis on the plane, yeah.
Exactly. And I guess in a way that was kind of a side benefit as well, because I knew from running a marathon, my doctor told me you've got to be a little bit careful to run a marathon then go and sit down for a long time on a plane just because you could get thrombosis. Anybody could. So the socks sort of had a side benefit there too.
All right. Socks are just the least of the concerns that David Gething had over his time running seven marathons on seven continents in 7 days as part of the World Marathon Challenge in early 2015. He did win, but whew, what it took to win. His book is called Relentless. We'll come back and talk more with David and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us. We'll return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is David Gething, a veterinary surgeon in Hong Kong, but we're not talking to him about animals other than humans and how they weather extreme conditions, because he did, and so did a bunch of other people, when they took on the first World Marathon Challenge in early 2015, which is seven marathons, seven continents, 7 days. David ended up winning the whole thing, and he tells the story of the experience in his book, Relentless. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about things that human beings endure and what it was like from David's perspective as he went through all this. Maybe you have some stories to share of your own endurance trials. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we were talking about trying to get some rest. Basically, you were either in a seat or running. How did you keep the calories on, considering what you must have been expending over the course of 7 days and seven marathons?
That's actually a really good question. I went out there with this bag of power bars and power gels and goos and all these kind of things that you eat while you're running. Because, I mean, we didn't really have any solid meals otherwise, apart from what we ate on the plane. And I ate a lot of goos and power bars, and after a week of that, I never, ever want to eat another one again.
I understand.
Yeah, not the most pleasant thing. But a lot of airplane food and food in airports, but mainly just kind of whatever we could eat, whenever we could eat it, we got it on board and ate it, and that was fine.
The dynamics of race strategy begin to show up by the time you get to the second marathon on the second day in Punta Arenas, Chile. You describe running packs and races are kind of like wolf packs. How is that?
Look, you're totally right, and I think this is the big difference between a stage race versus a day race. You know, if you go and run Boston Marathon, you're running against 10,000 whatever other people you don't know, whereas if you're running a stage race, you're running and competing against yourself but also against other individuals, and so you learn after a while of your strengths versus other people's strengths and how to play your strengths to maximize your benefits, and everyone does that. But you also, you make friends out there, you have people who you can get on with and work with, and that kind of helps you a little bit to keep you sane and motivated. When the time's tough to keep you going. But it becomes difficult. And, I think any kind of race, especially a long race, wears you down. And when you wear yourself down, all of those social niceties and conventions go out the window. And you have to be quite careful, too, not to get too punchy and too aggressive about it all.
Was there some snapping and sniping between different racers?
Oh, absolutely. And I only saw what I saw firsthand, but I'm sure everybody had it. And the funny thing is, I was competing with guys in second and third place, but the guys in fifth and sixth place were also competing, because to them, first place was out of contention, but they wanted to race against each other. So we all remained friends, but I think a lot of people had moments where things broke down. I think you mentioned rightly in Punta Arenas in Chile, I had to go for a bathroom break halfway through, and that's fair enough. That happens. And I kind of felt, for right or wrong, that, one of the other guys out there sort of took advantage of that. And I thought that wasn't fair at the time. And maybe it was fair. Maybe I was just feeling low on emotion and getting too sensitive about things. But I was hopping mad by that stage. I didn't get angry outwardly, but I was angry in myself. And I think that continued on until Miami, where he and I actually eventually had sort of like an argument in the middle of the race. And funny the way these arguments work, you have this sort of shouting match, then you end up hugging and saying, let's be friends from here on. And maybe it was actually good we got it all out in the open and had a bit of a shout, and then we decided to put our differences aside, work together.
Well, so, I mean, it sounds like by this point, and this is you mentioned the third race in Miami, the sanity is probably running a little thin by this time. So, I mean, how do you keep your wits about you, given all that you were doing to your body, and you got the disorientation of jet lag and being in different places and different climates? I mean, I remember reading an account of somebody who ran the Boston Marathon in the 60s saying that he was hallucinating mounds of ice cream by the time he got to downtown Boston. That was one race, and you guys are running seven. So, I mean, would hallucinations or other mental health breaks happen there?
Oh, look, I think you're totally right. And I think you add, you know, severe stress to your body. As you say, combined with time zone stress, combined with emotional stress and pressure and poor diet and so forth. And you do become very, very tender and easily sort of confused, upset. But I think in a way that's kind of why I quite like these races. They strip away all of that covering that you put on yourself normally, and all those sort of shields and masks that we all put on every day and when we go out to the real world. It takes that away and exposes exactly who you are for good and for bad. And I think you learn a lot about yourself, about who you really are, and also about what you're really capable of when you push your body through the limits like that.
Wow, you're really nothing but a running animal, it sounds like.
I don't know about that. I'm pretty human like anybody else. I have my bad days as well as my good days. Don't worry. I mean, definitely even on this race series, I had a lot of days where I could hardly think, oh, I can't start today. I've had enough. But I think it's that trick of, you know, you just got to put one foot after the other sometimes too and just keep going.
Let's take a call here. We have Don and Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Geffing, the author of Relentless. Don, you there?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't know I was there. Hi, David. Don Dolan here. And I ran the Boston Marathon. I took about 13 months to train to get it to do it. And I ran it under 3 hours, which was my, you know, presumed goal. I never hoped to have it happen, but I did. And I am just such in awe of your crazy stunt, all of you. I wrote a book about it, David, and I called it Crazies. The Road to Boston is littered with crazies. And you are the craziest of all.
Right. Let's see how he takes that compliment. Thanks, Don.
Well, look, thanks for your call, and I appreciate it. I've got to say, running sub-3 in Boston is certainly something to be proud of. I've been there myself, and it's an awesome race. And it's a tough course, too. So to run a sub-3 on that is doing really, really well. I actually went the year after the bombing, and I had a race entry for a year that they did have the bombing, and I just, for personal reasons, family reasons, I couldn't go. But the next year I wanted to go and sort of support. And I was blown away by, people could have reacted in a whole lot of ways to that, but the way the people in Boston reacted was just to open their arms and welcome people in. And it was just one of those, I mean, it sort of still brings shivers to my spine when I think about it. It's one of those kind of life-changing moments where you see how good people really can be. So if you've run Boston as well, I think you've had a privilege there. I've been lucky to do that too. But you're right. I think any guy who goes out, or any guy or girl who goes out and runs these races, I don't just mean seven marathons. I mean doing marathon races and all the training you put in. You have to be a little bit crazy. I totally agree.
We had an earlier question from Jamie in Medford who wanted to know if you had set a record. You had. You still apparently own the fastest marathon time in Antarctica. We did go look up, though, to see the most marathons completed in 1 year by a male. That's 239. 239 marathons in a single year by a guy named Larry Macon in the United States, who started in December of 2012 and finished in November of 2013. So, youch. There are people who've done a lot. Yeah, isn't that amazing?
I mean, this is the thing. Whenever you start doing stuff that, as Donna put it, is crazy, you realize there's guys who are way more crazy out there than you are. And you're totally right. I did this race in Florida this year. I did a double Ironman. And that was, 6.5-mile swim and a 300-mile bike ride and a 54-mile run. And I thought that was pretty tough. Got to the starting line, there's a guy who just set the world record for time spent on a treadmill doing marathons. He'd run like nonstop on a treadmill for a week or something at a time. So I agree with you. There's always one more crazy than you are.
it's like Infinity. You can always add one day or 1 minute or one race.
Yeah. It's impressive.
So you were able to get in contact with people during the process of doing the World Marathon Challenge, and your coach was able to point out a flaw in strategy after the first two races. What did he tell you in an email?
Oh, look, that's totally right. You know, and I was feeling very proud of myself by this stage because I'd won both these races by quite a big margin, and I was I had about 45 minutes lead overall in the race standings. And I thought how clever I was. And he sort of said, look, you're a complete idiot. You've blown this. And if you keep running like this, you're not going to finish, never mind winning. And he also said, rightly put, that the guy in second place, Doug, and I were going out and literally fighting tooth and nail every day to beat each other. And we were going to both ruin it for each other. And it was time to just settle down a bit. And I guess that was part of, I mentioned before about being in Miami and sort of deciding to be friends rather than fighting it out. And I guess that email was the first step in that journey to making it so we work together rather than work against each other. I got to say, I mean, that's something I learned on this race, is that you've got to work with people, even if they're your competitors. You know, sometimes you can't always be fighting. You've got to be working together as well.
And how much contact with Trilby and your daughters while you were on the Odyssey?
Not much. I mean, you know, because I'd shoot off an email and it wouldn't be until I got to the end of the next place and found a Wi-Fi hotspot that I could hear from them again. A few phone calls here and there, but it was all pretty rushed. So it was difficult. And that actually really got to be a strain. Because, you know, after a few days you get quite emotional, and things that are not really a big problem normally, they really can start getting to you. And I became quite homesick, and I don't know why. I mean, I was only away for a week. People can survive without me, but I got quite sensitive about it all. So by the time I got to Morocco, actually, I landed in Morocco, and my wife had sent me this. Truly, had sent me this picture of my younger daughter, Madeline, who was 5 years old at the time, and she was starting her first day of school without me being there. She was sort of dressed in a new school uniform, so proud of herself, and I just felt that was one of those moments where I felt such a low point of what am I doing and why am I here? And I just wanted to get home straight away and to get back to my family. Luckily enough, one of the other racers, a guy called Jim, sort of said, look, you know, we're all feeling it, but you got to just get out there and start and see how you go. And I got to credit him, because without him dragging me to the starting line, I was all set to call it quits right then and there.
Emotions aside, how was your body doing? I mean, it sounds like you had a few swellings and potential bumps and bruises and dents and dings. I mean, how did you determine which ones were ones you could run with and which ones might have actually threatened your finishing?
Actually, well, you're totally right. I mean, I didn't, right from the start, I wasn't the cleverest out there. I wore Gore-Tex shoes in Antarctica, and they made the sweat at the tip of my toes, because they're waterproof, the sweat sort of stayed in the shoes and it actually did freeze. And the tip of my second toe on both foot was covered by the ice that went black. And I'm pretty sure that was frostbite, because the tip actually fell off eventually. And I'm only talking the tip. I'm not going to make it, you know, only sort of a quarter of an inch or so fell off the end.
That's a lot of toes.
It's not like I've lost a whole toe. Well, actually, the weird thing was my second toe was always longer than my big toe. And I always used to get really bad. I always used to get really bad blisters every time I ran for long distance, and now they're exactly the same length, and I get no more blisters. So I actually look at it as a benefit rather than a curse. It's worked out for the best. But look, you're right. You know, and the damage every day, the damage adds up, and you get worse and worse. And what could have been a blister on day one, by day four or five, is a huge hole. I mean, the worst injury I got was in Morocco. And, you know, we flew and we landed, and you pretty much had to run as soon as you landed to try and keep on that time schedule. So when we landed in Morocco, it was 2 a.m. and it was dark and it was raining and it was pretty miserable. I thought Morocco was going to be like the Sahara Desert and hot and sunny, but it's exactly the opposite. halfway down the race course, I wasn't watching where I was going. I landed in a pothole and I twisted my right ankle, and there's this sort of sickening crack. It was just agony. And I'm pretty sure I got a stress fracture in my ankle that day. And a stress fracture is not as bad as a full fracture. You can still run on it. It's just really sore. But luckily, you know, that sort of alliance I made with the guy in second, Doug, paid off, and he stood by me and he sort of got me going again. He talked me through it, and I got to the finish line. The ankle swelled up like a grapefruit the next day, but it was just runnable.
So how much weight did you lose over the course of this 7 day, seven continent, seven marathon odyssey?
You know, that is one of the best questions I've asked, and I've got no idea because I never actually thought to stop and check. I should have probably been the best diet plan. I could have sold it on to anyone around the world to lose 20 pounds a week. I should have checked. I don't know, but I can tell you what, when I got to Sydney, Australia, the next morning I had the biggest breakfast you have ever imagined with everything I never would have eaten otherwise.
Well, it's an amazing story and a lot here that we didn't get a chance to cover, but because there were seven continents in 7 days. So Antarctica, South America, in Punta Arenas, Miami, Madrid, Marrakesh, Dubai, and Sydney were all the stops along the way. And it's a story well told in the book Relentless, Seven Marathons, Seven Continents, 7 Days by David Gething. David, thanks for joining us and for staying up tonight in Hong Kong.
It's been great to speak to you, Jeff. Thanks so much.
All right, take care.